This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
In Tonga, help is on the way after the massive volcano eruption.
We're ensuring that the supplies get to Tonga.
But worries are growing that the aid workers might also bring COVID, which the nation has kept at bay. I'm Carol Hills. And in Cuba, protesters took to the streets last summer and took the authorities by surprise. But
everyone knows the consequences they face.
That means mass trials and possible prison sentences. And in Ghana, health officials are stepping up their push to get people vaxxed.
Ago! Fellow Ghanaians, the Ministry of Health, Ghana Health Service and partners are reminding you that the COVID-19 vaccination continues.
Get vaccinated at restaurants or at the beach. Just do it, they say. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're going to start in Tonga today. More and more information is emerging from the Pacific nation following the eruption of a massive underwater volcano there last weekend. Officials have confirmed at least 3 people dead, and photos taken by New Zealand and Australian military surveillance planes show wrecked coastlines from tsunami waves and damaged homes and buildings covered in ash. International aid has begun to mobilize, but as Ashley Westerman reports, officials are wary of letting outsiders into Tonga.
3 days after the Hunga Tonga Hunga Ha'apai volcano violently erupted, the world finally heard directly from Tongan officials. In a 2-page statement released Tuesday, the government confirmed that telecommunications had been cut when an underwater fiber optic cable was damaged by the huge eruption. It went on to say that evacuations and relief efforts were underway. New Zealand and Australia were the first nations to pledge support for Tonga, promising to get aid on the ground as soon as conditions allowed. Tonga's High Commissioner to Australia, Curtis Tu'i Halaninya, praised them on Radio Australia Tuesday, particularly for agreeing to help keep Tonga virtually COVID-free.
And we are very happy because the Australian government, New Zealand, they agree to keep Tonga and maintain Tonga as it is. As much as we're going to send assistance to Tonga, we will still need to follow COVID-19 protocols to keep the people and the population safe.
Tonga has had 1 case of COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic, recorded only last November. This feat has only been achieved by essentially cutting itself off from the world, even at the expense of their export and tourism-driven economy. But even though well over half of Tonga's population of some 105,000 are fully vaccinated, fears of international aid workers bringing in the coronavirus have prevailed, forcing aid groups to support the archipelago nation remotely.
The COVID restrictions still stand. The borders are still closed.
Dr. Francis Vulivuli is based in Suva, Fiji, and is a health and nutrition specialist with the United Nations Children's Fund. She says they'll just have to work around it
until we are able to get in the country. In the meantime, we are ensuring that the supplies get to Tonga so that they can be used and respond accordingly to the needs right now.
Right now, the priority is dealing with the ash that fell during the eruption, blanketing whole landscapes, says Vulivuli. Tongan officials have reported that the ash has already started contaminating residents' drinking water. So UNICEF staff based in the country are handing out water purification tablets, she says. But if left too long, the ash could also cause respiratory issues as well as hurt crops and livestock. Meanwhile, Esteban Gazelle, a geologist at Cornell University, says there is other environmental damage to contend with.
Because this eruption happened underwater, besides magmatic gases that turn into acids, there are going to be more salt because of the interaction of magma with seawater. And that's going to result in acids like hydrochloric acid, for example.
These acids make the ocean unsafe for people and marine life. Volcanologists say Saturday's eruption was a rarely powerful and unexpected event. Gazelle says better monitoring of volcanoes across the world would help prevent getting caught off guard in the future.
We at least should not have these surprises. We should know that at least the majority of eruptions are going to have with time so we can prepare better.
But that would be a global effort, he says, and not just one shouldered by those most affected by volcanoes. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman in Manila.
We'll have more for you on our global reliance on those undersea communications cables later in the show. In the United Kingdom, it's been yet another bruising day for Prime Minister Boris Johnson. He's facing calls to resign, and not just from the political opposition. Lawmakers from his own party are saying it's time for him to go. And today, one member of parliament from Johnson's Conservative Party defected to join the Labour Party. Boris Johnson is still facing questions about a series of parties held at 10 Downing Street while Britain was under a strict lockdown. The World's Orla Barry joins us from London. Orla, the Prime Minister gave an interview last night where he once again tried to defend himself regarding the parties at 10 Downing Street. Did he manage to convince voters or party colleagues with his response?
Frankly, no, Carl, it was a pretty disastrous interview. Specifically, he was asked about a drinks party held in Downing Street in May of 2020 when Britain was under a strict lockdown. And last week, Johnson told Parliament that he went to this party, albeit briefly, but he thought it was a work event and he didn't realise it was against the rules. Well, this week, Johnson's former chief advisor, now probably his greatest nemesis, Dominic Cummings, said he categorically warned Johnson that the proposed party was against the rules. So last night in this interview, Sky News asked Johnson if he was warned about it.
Nobody told me, I'm absolutely categorical about it. Nobody said to me, this is an event that is against the rules, that is in breach of what we're asking everybody else to do, should not go ahead.
Hmm. Still, removing Boris Johnson as Prime Minister is not an easy task. What exactly is involved?
Yeah, there's a number of ways Johnson could be removed from office. The obvious one is if he resigned himself, which by all accounts he has no notion of doing. The one that's most likely is a vote of no confidence in him by his party colleagues. And this vote requires 54 Conservative MPs to write a letter to the Conservative Committee, a committee that's known as the 1922 Committee, saying that they want to trigger a leadership challenge. Then if that vote goes ahead, around 180 Conservative MPs would then need to vote against him for Boris Johnson to be removed. So the question today is, will 54 of his party colleagues, first of all, write a letter calling for a no confidence motion in him? And then would he survive a no confidence vote in Parliament?
But we do know a lot of Conservative MPs, his own party colleagues, are disillusioned with him. We saw one of them defect to the Labour Party today, right?
That's right. Christian Wakeford, a Tory MP who was just elected in the last general election in 2019, he crossed the House today to the opposition benches just before Boris Johnson took the stand to answer Prime Minister's questions. So it was a particularly excruciating timing for the Prime Minister. And the opposition Labour Party, of course, erupted in cheers. And there was others who spoke out as well today, most specifically in Parliament. The most sort of devastating comment came from another senior lawmaker in the party, former Tory minister David Davis.
Like many on these benches, I spent weeks and months defending the Prime Minister against often angry constituents. But I expect my leaders to shoulder the responsibility for the actions they take. Yesterday, he did the opposite of that. So I'll remind him of a quotation altogether too familiar to him of Leo Amery, to Neville Chamberlain. You have sat there too long for all the good you have done. In the name of God, go.
Ouch. I mean, could Boris Johnson be out of power by the end of the week?
Yeah, the million-dollar question. I mean, Johnson is famous for so many gaffes over the years, but he's always managed to bounce back. But this time it does seem to be pretty fatal. The public are furious. For a lot of people, this is really personal. You know, people who couldn't spend any time with their loved ones or their sick relatives say they see a man who laid down the rules openly breaking them. On the other hand, there's a lot of Tory MPs today saying, look, let's hold off until next week when we see the findings of this Sue Gray report. So this is the report investigating the parties held at 10 Downing Street. And the Tory MPs say, let's see what she has to say and make our decision then. The polls at the moment have him, I mean, they're terrible. His personal approval rating is now lower than Theresa May's was at her darkest hour. So it does seem to many it's just a matter of time before he goes, that it's not a question of if, but when.
The World's Orla Barry in London. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Carl.
There's some cautious good news about the Omicron variant. The head of the World Health Organization says the infections worldwide appear to be slowing down. Here's Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus.
In some countries, cases seem to have peaked, which gives hope that the worst of this latest wave is done with, but no country is out of the woods yet.
Here in the US, in Canada, and some parts of Europe, the spread is believed to be at its peak. To discuss these trends and what they may mean, we're joined by Helen Branswell. She's a senior writer at STAT, a health news site. Helen, in what regions is Omicron actually declining?
The World Health Organization said that cases are actually declining in Africa, but in other parts of the world, they're still on the rise. For instance, in Southeast Asia, last week saw a 145% increase in cases, and the Middle East saw a 68% increase in cases. So it's really variable across the world. Places that are further along in their Omicron wave, such as North America and Europe, are starting to see a slowing and decline, but elsewhere, it's very much still on the rise.
So if certain parts of the U.S. and some other countries around the world may be at their peak with Omicron, what does that mean exactly?
Well, it means that this absolutely stunning increase of cases, the growth in cases is stopping. But that doesn't mean there aren't still tons of people infected and sickening other people. And that's going to continue for quite a while. One of the things we don't sometimes think about is when we look at an epidemiological curve, there are at least as many people who are infected on the downside of the curve as there are on the front end of it, sometimes more if there's a long tail to the outbreak. So even if we are at or near the peak, or in, you know, the cases of the Northeast, maybe even a little bit past the peak, there's still several weeks of heightened Omicron activity and lots of people who will contract the virus over the next 3-4 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, the WHO logged 18 million cases last week. That was up from 15 million the week before. So it's interesting how that's considered a slowdown, but I guess it's a scientific issue around cases and peaking.
It does seem a little bit of a Pyrrhic victory, doesn't it? I mean, it's still a ton of infections, but it's not growing at the same rate as it was earlier.
Because Omicron kind of cut a swath through so many people, through so many populations, that overall there may be good news in that there's more general immunity in the community. Is that valid?
Yes, it is certainly true that, you know, now there is more immunity than there was in late November when we first spotted Omicron. The immunological landscape is different. And by the time this variant works its way around the globe, there will be a lot more immunity globally to this version of SARS-2. And, you know, I actually have a story out today on STAT. I talked to a bunch of immunologists and virologists who actually suggest that we may get a little bit of a lull after the Omicron variant because there will be so much immunity in the population. We may actually sort of see a slowing of transmission, a sort of a period of detente, if you will. You know, there are no guarantees because a new variant could emerge and change that, although several of the people I spoke to thought it would be hard for a variant to come out and find enough susceptible people to take off in the way that Delta or Omicron did. But even if there is a lull, you know, there's no guarantee how long it will last, but it would be, you know, a very welcome thing, I think, for healthcare workers who have been just battered for months and months and months with huge numbers of cases.
Helen Branswell is a senior writer with STAT. Thanks a lot, Helen.
Thanks for having me.
The U.S. is muddling through questions about 5G networks and their impact on airplanes. How Europe is approaching the question, that's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Let's turn to a developing situation in Turkey. The Council of Europe is threatening sanctions on Turkey if it does not release a political prisoner named Osman Kavala. The 64-year-old civil society leader has been detained for 4 years without a conviction. Today was a deadline for Turkey to respond to the accusations. Advocates had hoped for his release, but Kavala remains behind bars. Here to tell us more about this is The World's Duri Buskaran. She's in Istanbul. Duri, first of all, who is Osman Kavala and why is this case such a big deal in Turkey?
Osman Kavala is a longtime face of Turkey's arts and culture scene. He's best known for projects that were mainly cross-cultural dialogues, like bringing kids from Armenia and Turkey together to talk and reconcile the past, efforts to help Syrian refugees feel at home here. His work wasn't political, and that's kind of why this is such a big deal, because while it definitely pushed the envelope, a lot of people saw him as a sign of hope for liberalism and democracy and change in Turkey. Kavala is also accused of trying to overthrow the Turkish government. Prosecutors are claiming that he's a spy, that he worked for the CIA, and that he was behind a coup attempt in 2016 that left hundreds of people dead.
So what is the government's evidence against him?
The charges against him are largely seen as fairly political and very arbitrary. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has also repeatedly said in speeches and in public that he thinks Kavala is guilty, which makes it pretty clear that Kavala can't have a fair trial here. The European Court of Human Rights took up the case and decided that there's not enough evidence to suggest Osman Kavala did anything wrong, and it believes that Turkey is depriving Kavala of his rights by keeping him in prison. At the same time, here in Turkey, Kavala's case is seen by a lot of Turks as a symbol of the opposition and the government's control over civil society and dissent. There's a lot of journalists, there's a lot of opposition politicians and Kurdish activists that remain behind bars even today.
As we mentioned, the Council of Europe is threatening sanctions against Turkey if Kavala isn't released, but a judge ruled this week to keep him in jail. So what happens next?
Right. So Turkey's criminal court ruled on Monday that Kavala should remain in prison as his trial here in Turkey goes on. And what this means is that the Council of Europe, which has decided he should be released, they have a committee of ministers meeting on February 2nd. Where it will hold a vote on whether to formally begin what's called an infringement process against Turkey. This is where they send the case back to the European Court of Human Rights to decide what kind of sanctions they'll place on Turkey for keeping Kavala in jail. Only three countries voted against the process in the last meeting, Turkey being one of them, so we're pretty sure that they'll have the votes to go forward if Kavala remains in prison.
So what's the bigger picture here, Duri?
The Turkey director of Human Rights Watch, Emma Sinclair Webb, says that this is part of Turkey's shift since the coup attempt in 2016.
We've seen, you know, an entrenched crisis of the justice system in Turkey, political control of courts, a government that's willing to override international law, disregard it all the time, and speeches by the president on a very regular basis, shunning all the terms, the rules of international law.
She says it's a really strange situation because Turkey is moving away from the Western alliance on one hand, but on the other, in the next breath, it's saying that it wants to join the EU still. This is also the second time in the history of the Council of Europe that it's begun infringement proceedings against one of its members. The first one is Azerbaijan, and that wasn't even that long ago. Azerbaijan actually released the opposition, a politician that was at the center of that issue. Another one coming down the line is likely the Navalny case in Russia. And then there's another one from Turkey, a Kurdish politician named Selahattin Demirtas. So this institution that emerged after World War II as part of this new liberal world order to protect human rights in Europe, we're seeing countries that are moving in an authoritarian direction that are taking these institutions' decisions and saying, meh, whatever. So we'll see what happens next.
The World's Duri Buskaran in Istanbul. Thanks a lot, Duri.
Thanks for having me.
For the past couple of years, the aviation industry has taken a big hit. Of course, COVID is the biggest reason for that. People are reluctant to fly. But staff shortages have also slowed things down considerably, resulting in delays and flight cancellations. Today, though, scores of airlines have canceled or changed many U.S.-bound flights for another reason, 5G. To tell us why, we're joined now by Phil Seymour. He's an aviation analyst with the IBA consulting firm in the UK. Phil, why is 5G causing many airlines to cancel or change flights bound for the US?
The issue is for aircraft, especially when they're landing in bad weather, they rely on a radio altimeter, which uses a radio beacon at the airport. And if an aircraft is approaching the runway, a readout will happen such as 50 feet, 40 feet, 30 feet, 20 feet, 10 feet. So even in very bad weather, the pilot is absolutely aware of how high above the ground he is. So that radio beacon around the airports in the US is potentially going to be interfered by the 5G beacons. The FAA consider it to be of concern enough that they're saying that any 5G masts within close proximity to US airports really can't be used until there's a fix.
Why is this a problem in the US and not, say, where you're based in the UK?
Well, it's because the mobile network providers here are using a different frequency, which isn't as close to the airport radio beacons, and it's a lower voltage. Now, I don't know if that was clever thinking on part of the mobile networks or liaison with the aviation authorities, or whether it is just coincidence that they knew what the radio beacon frequencies was around airports and therefore chose not to go near it. So it does look as if there's been, you know, a distinct lack of coordination between the network providers and the US FAA.
It seems to be a huge miscalculation or oversight. How do you explain it?
Well, the mobile network providers will actually say that it's not the same frequency. It may be close to, but in their opinion, there is no safety issue. But it's the FAA who deemed it to be a problem. And as far as I understand, this was raised in early 2020 by the aviation authorities to the mobile network providers. It does seem extraordinary that we get to a situation where the day before the switch is meant to be flicked, that the network providers are basically saying they're going to have to think about how they manage this.
What's the scope of this problem and how quickly do you think it can be fixed?
Well, from a positive perspective, this will impact around 50 airports in the USA. It won't be every single airport. So, as far as I understand, the assessment is going on in terms of exactly where the 5G radio masts are in relation to each and every airport and each and every runway. So the easy fix is that those particular masts would not be activated. There will be other 5G masts in the area. So in terms of, you know, the general consumer relying on 5G, so long as they're not within a couple of miles of an airport, would still get a 5G signal. But around the airports, there will be either reliance on, you know, the current 3G or 4G network rather than 5G.
Phil Seymour is an aviation analyst with the IBA consulting firm in the UK. He's been talking to us about how installment of 5G tech near airports in the US has led to scores of canceled or changed flights. Thanks a lot, Phil.
A pleasure.
You're listening to The World. We're still waiting to hear about the fallout from the volcanic explosion that hit Tonga, but one impact is clear. It cut a crucial line of undersea cables.
Everyone thinks satellites, they think wireless, they think Wi-Fi, but everything goes through cables at some point or another.
Ocean floor links to the outside world. That story and more next on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Now, an update from Cuba. Demonstrations across the island nation last July took authorities by surprise. Officials arrested more than 1,000 protesters who took to the streets demanding change. Now those protesters are paying a heavy price for their activism. They're standing trial in large groups. Some are facing decades in prison. Allies of those detained are trying to draw attention to their plight. Activists like art historian and writer Carolina Barrero. She protested in front of Cuba's Supreme Court on Monday, demanding justice for the jailed protesters. Then she herself was detained. Cuban authorities have since released her. She joins us now from Havana. Carolina, why did you take the risk of protesting in front of Cuba's Supreme Court on Monday?
Well, this week, We had three trials, collective ones. These trials have been held at closed door. Only one member of the family is allowed. And the lawyers, the defense lawyers, cannot bring all the witnesses they would want, all the proof they would need. It's not happening a fair trial. It's more like a farce.
So you were out there on Monday to try to call attention to these trials, which are handing down very tough sentences. What happened to you while you were out there protesting?
Well, yes, we were three of us protesting in front of the Supreme Court. We had T-shirts with the messages saying freedom for the protesters. And we were detained for many hours, interrogations. We didn't stay in prison, which is a privilege, actually, because many people who has done exactly what we did Monday are still in prison from 2020.
Why do you think you were released?
Justice is completely kidnapped by the Communist Party, and they do selective use of justice. People that they know are less known. They have the most severe consequences. But if they know that by putting someone in prison that would bring more scandal, well, then they choose to release that person or have another kind of repression. We are all under a lot of vigilance and a lot of pressure and threats and harassment.
And you, of course, are well known. You're an artist and activist. So they possibly elected not to arrest you because you're well known. We know that at least 45 Cuban protesters from last summer are standing trial this week. 66 went before courts last week. Who are these Cuban detainees?
All towns in Cuba, people went out to the street, all ages, all professions. We have at least 130 minors were detained under the age of 20. 14 are in jail, and the other ones are in house arrest. At least five of them have been actually condemned.
I know some of those on trial are longtime activists, but others hadn't participated in protests before. Isn't that right?
Yes, we are talking about people who actually has never been under any kind of activism. They just went out there because they needed a change. Because people need to participate in the public life of the country, which is something we haven't done for over six decades.
They're hungry for change.
Yes.
Carolina, do you think you're taking a risk by talking to us today?
I have been doing this for more than a year now, and everyone knows the consequences they face. Fear is not an option anymore. I think people now have more fear of being silenced than to speak, even if your life is going to be completely changed because of that.
I know some of the families of those arrested have taken the risky step of criticizing Cuba's legal process on social media. What are the families saying, and what could be the consequences for them?
Imagine the pain and the horror for a mother of a young boy of 17 that is facing 23 years in prison just for being outside of the street, because some of them not even, actually, they were just passing by, some of them. I have been in touch with some of those mothers, and they have nothing to lose because they have lost what is more precious to a mother. And how can you prosecute the pain of a mother? All the families are being under harassment. They are facing threats. Some of them, they have police outside their houses, so they cannot go out to try to do something for their sons. Or even if they go outside court where the trials are happening, sometimes they are arrested. And this happened to the brothers of Andy Garcia last week.
You mentioned how upset and angry families of the detainees are. Let's listen for a moment to Luis Wilber, the father of Walnia Luis Aguiar Rivera, who's a 21-year-old who received a 23-year sentence for demonstrating. This father dared to make a video speaking out. Carolina, can you tell us what he's saying?
Yes, it doesn't matter what language that you speak. You can hear the pain and how angry he is, right? What he's saying here is he has 21 years. How can you condemn him to 23 years? These are more years of condemn than years of life, just for going out to the streets.
The father we just heard, are parents and relatives of those who are getting these stiff sentences, are they taking other kinds of action?
Well, they are doing what they can, which is not much because they are on full vigilance. They are denouncing some of them on social media. The ones that are not, it's because they have been threatened that if they say something, if they talk to press, if they go to social media, the relative in jail will suffer more. So they are blackmailed somehow, and they, you know, by fear they don't say. But some of them, they go, when the trials are happening, they go outside and they show their support, and they might do a small demonstration. But some of them have been detained because of that. But most of them, they are afraid to say what's really going on.
Cuban art historian and writer and activist Carolina Borrero protested in front of Cuba's Supreme Court on Monday, demanding justice for the jailed protesters. She was detained and then released. She's been speaking to us from Havana. Thank you, Carolina.
Thank you, Conrad.
Since Afghanistan fell to the Taliban last summer, tens of thousands of Afghans have been relocated to the U.S. Their first stay is usually a military base, then on to their new homes, at least for some. Nearly 20,000 Afghans remain on military bases. Reporter Daniel Ackerman brings us the story of one family whose journey took them from Kabul to eventually the city of New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Let's see if it's good or not.
In the crowded kitchen of a small second-story apartment, Parkanda Ehsan pops open a pressure cooker to check on the beans. She's making them in what she calls Afghan style.
Tomatoes, ginger, garlic, salt.
Across the room, her three kids wait for dinner. They play video games on their mom's phone, and the youngest climbs onto the table for an impromptu dance performance. Ehsan says she's grateful for these lighthearted moments because they've been hard to come by. In recent months, her family has spent most nights sleeping in tents on military bases in Qatar, Germany, and El Paso, Texas. They finally arrived at this apartment a couple weeks ago. Her long journey from Kabul to New Bedford started one morning back in August, but she didn't realize it at first.
When we woke up, everything was normal. My husband left for his job and kids left for their school.
Ehsan worked for the U.S. government's Agency for International Development. She helped train Afghan women to be journalists. Around 10 a.m. that day, Ehsan got a call from her sister-in-law.
And she told me that Taliban has came. I said, what are you saying? Joking? She said, no, just go and check.
She flipped on the TV to learn that the Taliban had captured Kabul. Panicked, she tried to call her husband, but she couldn't unlock her cell phone, too nervous to remember her passcode. She said her neighbors all across Kabul were feeling the same anxiety.
The people were very much afraid of Taliban. So everyone was hopeless that, oh, they have conquered the whole country. Now what? What will happen with our school, with our education, with our economy, with our culture? We don't know the answers.
10 days later, the U.S. military offered her family a flight out of Kabul, thanks to her work with the U.S. government. The banks had all closed, so despite her well-paying job, Ehsan took off with no money, just 6 gold bracelets around her wrist. Last month, her family was at a camp in El Paso. Ehsan was teaching an English class to other refugees one day when she got the text, alerting them where they would be resettled long-term. The place name was unfamiliar, Massachusetts. And that's when the Googling began.
The first thing I searched was the map. Where is Massachusetts situated?
She was glad to find it on the same side of the country as Virginia. Ehsan has a sister there. Her family spent their final days in El Paso glued to the internet, reading up on their future home state.
It has a good economy. The best schools are here. So, and the housing, that it's very expensive.
Arriving in New Bedford has meant at least a touch of normalcy. Ehsan could finally cook her own food for the family after months of being fed military-grade boiled eggs for breakfast.
And the thing that was very, very happy for my kids, the night we arrived, the morning we got up, so they were saying, Mom, cook us egg on our own style.
That's fried with a runny yolk.
So that was the egg I cooked for them. They were very, very happy for that.
Ehsan's husband found work at a warehouse, and Ehsan is looking. In the meantime, she's helping her family settle into New Bedford, with trips to the playground and a visit to the local mosque, plus taking in some of the city's signature sites, like the waterfront.
We have seen the fishing boats. My kids have been asking, what are they? I said, this fishing. So can we take that? I said, one day. One day we will take one of it and we will go for fishing.
Five families who fled Afghanistan this summer have now settled in New Bedford. More are waiting to come, but it's been hard to find housing. Ihsan says she plans to start a mutual aid group to support other Afghan refugees. For now, though, she's taking things one step at a time, like getting her kids registered for school, while also keeping them connected to their homeland through their first language, Dari, which she also calls Persian.
To be very honest, I told them, you learn English at your school, but you're at home, you try to speak in Persian so you don't forget your own language, because it will help them again. I hope we can have a time to move back to our country, be in the country, see our country, so they should not forget their own language.
She says that hope is what keeps her going as she begins building a life here in New Bedford. For The World, I'm Daniel Ackerman in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Do you need a pick-me-up? Everyone can use a feel-good moment during their day. Our daily newsletter always has a moment of joy or wonder, along with our top news stories. Subscribe to our newsletter, Top of the World, at theworld.org/newsletters. The underwater volcanic eruption in the South Pacific disrupted a lot more than just life above ground. It also cut a crucial line of communication beneath the ocean.
Well, we're hoping to get some information when the cable repair ship goes nearby. Now, that cable was broken quite some distance from the volcano, so we're not quite sure what happened.
That's volcanologist Shane Cronin in Auckland, New Zealand. We don't know why that undersea cable broke, but we do know that it severed links to the outside, delaying what the rest of the world knew about what was happening in Tonga. These cables on the ocean floor are the expertise of Nicole Staroselsky at New York University. She's the author of The Undersea Network, which examines the cultural and environmental dimensions of transoceanic cable systems. She spoke with The World's Marco Werman.
So I am really ready to nerd out on undersea cables, Nicole. Let's start with the basics. What exactly do these cables do and who installs them?
So they carry around 99% of the internet between continents underneath the ocean, and they're laid on the very bottom of the seafloor. So they're not draped between underwater volcanoes. They're laid to the contour of the ocean floor, and they're fiber optic. And so all the information that this phone call, the radio broadcast that goes through the internet, emails, TikTok videos, all of that gets sent at the speed of light through these cables between countries.
As you said, this is fiber optic cable. I mean, even with a lot of reliance on satellites, are we on Earth mostly using these cables for all the megabytes we're sending around the globe? I mean, it sounds like 90%+, yeah.
Yes. You know, everyone thinks satellites. They think wireless. They think Wi-Fi. But everything goes through cables at some point or another, and cables are the backbone of the global internet.
So these cables continued to be laid on the ocean floor across the planet, but was there a period when there was a rush to connect many places on Earth via these cables?
There were several rushes. The first rush was the telegraph cable rush, which happened in the 19th century. And, you know, that was free radio. It was the form of transoceanic communication, and it connected all the continents. And then the second rush was in the mid-20th century, was telephone cables. And then the last rush was fiber optic cables. And that occurred in the 1980s and 90s. Those cables are laid still today.
And obviously these cables are critical. But I mean, as we've seen with Tonga, it's critical. And when they go down, then what happens?
Well, in most places, there are more than one cable. And so that way, there's always a backup or a backup route, backup network.
But are there any countries that don't have backup?
Well, many countries don't have a second cable or don't have diverse cable routes that can protect communications in times like this. In that case, they go to a satellite backup, but satellite's a far inferior backup. It doesn't have the same speed. It doesn't have the same capacity. It's not built out to support the communications that we have today. And so in places like Tonga, you know, when there's a cable cut, there's potentially this complete severing, even with satellite backup, of the majority of communications.
In terms of maintenance and upkeep, I mean, who is responsible, especially in a situation where a volcano disrupts or snaps a sea cable? Who has to fix it?
all the companies that own these cables and operate these cables have maintenance agreements. And so there are ships on standby, ready, in ports all over the world to rush to fix the internet immediately.
How frequently do events like the Tonga volcano eruption impact or affect these sea cables' ability to function?
This is a far less frequent occurrence than you might think. The most frequent disruption is people dropping anchors or dragging trawl nets across cables.
I'm curious, Nicole, what are your thoughts about this heavy reliance on undersea cables as we go into a future with more data, more reliance on this technology? Are we captive to this global network of fiber optic cables?
There's a cable cut once every 3 days. I think there was a recent estimate. So they're cut all the time, right? And yet we have this really resilient and kind of secure cable network. And so I think that we have something that works pretty well. But the problem is places where there's not a ton of economic rationale for really creating a stable system, that you get faults.
What is the best way, do you think, to preserve this fiber optic cable network? How do we protect it as it's become so critical to global communication?
I think that what you need is diversity. You need diversity of routing. You need diversity of ownership. You actually need physically different routes in order to make sure that you have security, that you have these kinds of backup cable routes.
Nicole Staroselsky is a professor at New York University and the author of The Undersea Network. Nicole, thank you very much for explaining all of this.
Thank you for having me.
Here are two sobering numbers for you. Only 6.6% of Africa's population of 1.3 billion people are fully vaxxed. In Ghana, health officials have stepped up a vaccination campaign at venues like nightclubs, beaches, and restaurants. It's meant to tackle vaccine hesitancy there. Ridwan Karim Dini Osman reports from one vaccination site in Ghana's capital, Accra.
At the Adabraka Hospital, Gloria Yabua broods over how the COVID-19 pandemic has reversed the course of what life used to be. The 18-year-old is in her final year of high school. She misses the parties and is getting tired of wearing masks.
Some people died. I didn't lose anyone personally, but I knew a few people that died from COVID and had to pause school for a bit, couldn't write exams.
Not far from where she sits, health officers are busy assembling vaccination materials as more than a dozen people wait their turn to get the COVID-19 jab. Yabua was finally convinced after having to pay about $50 every time she went somewhere that required a COVID test.
So at least with this vaccine, I know I'm protected. Even though I still have to mask up, I know I'm protected.
Shortly after Yabua takes her turn, Desmond Amua also rolls up his sleeves to receive the COVID-19 jab. The 40-year-old civil servant says it is the fear of being infected with a recently discovered coronavirus variant, Omicron, that has pushed him to get the shot.
I see it as a defense for myself against the virus. So I've just taken the step to get myself vaccinated and with the hope that it is what I need to stand against the virus.
More than 154,000 cases of coronavirus have been confirmed in Ghana since the pandemic began, and more than 1,300 deaths. The World Health Organization says Ghana has one of the best COVID-19 testing programs in Africa. But like most nations on the continent, vaccination uptake has been slow, despite an increase in supplies over the last few months. For instance, at this vaccination center, officials say misinformation and myths about the vaccines are still circulating among the public. Steven Obing is the administrator at the Adabraka Hospital.
Actually, when we started vaccinations, we were doing between 500 people a day. That was like our peak, during our peak. But when the low turnout came in, for instance, these people could be here in a day. They might do just like 50 people a day.
So far, less than 3 million people out of the country's population of more than 30 million are fully vaccinated. In the Volta region in eastern Ghana, nearly 13,000 vaccines expired during the last vaccination campaign. Now, there is a mandate for targeted groups, including government employees, health workers, security officials, and students at the end of January, and even radio jingles in different Ghanaian languages.
Ago! Fellow Ghanaians, the Ministry of Health, Ghana Health Service and partners are reminding you that the COVID-19 vaccination continues. Moderna, AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer vaccines authorized by FDA
have been given to all persons. Dr. Kwame Amponsa Achianu is with the Ghana Health Service in charge of the expanded program on immunization.
We have a whole subcommittee on communication that is working on all kinds of strategies to get the information appropriately to the people.
Back at the Adabraka Vaccination Center, Gloria Yabua urges people to disregard misinformation and conspiracy theories and endeavor to get vaccinated.
Please, there is no chip in the vaccine. I beg, take it. It's not the mark of the beast. I don't know what you've heard. Please just take your vaccine. Like, it's not even that painful, I guess. It's calm. Just take the vaccine. You'll be fine. Trust.
For the world, this is Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
The German word doppelganger has become a part of the English lexicon. It translates to double goer or double walker, and it refers to people who look like twins but are not related. One photographer in Canada is on a quest to capture them all. The World's Bianca Hillier has the story.
Growing up, Francois Brunel was aware of his own doppelganger.
When I was younger, people would tell me I looked like a certain Mr. Bean.
Mr. Bean, the famous British sitcom character played by Rowan Atkinson.
Bean.
Brunel didn't know how to take the comparison at first, but over the years, he grew more and more fascinated with the idea of lookalikes. He became a professional photographer in Montreal and sent out a call asking to take pictures of doppelgangers across the globe.
I got these emails from all over the world. I got overwhelmed with thousands and thousands of emails.
Decades later, Brunel has captured hundreds of doppelgangers from about 50 different cities, including in countries like Colombia, Germany, England, and the U.S. Georgia friends Michael Malone and Charlie Chasen lent their likeness to the project.
We've had a couple of cases of mistaken identity that have been pretty amusing, I would say.
Oh, yes. We have some fun stories.
Malone and Chasen hail from different parts of the world, but they look remarkably similar. Same beard, same black hair, same face structure. See for yourself at theworld.org/Instagram. Chasen says when he first moved to Malone's town, he would even get stopped in the grocery store.
And it took me like maybe 3 or 4 times. And like on the 4th time, I said to the person, "Do you think I'm Michael Malone?" And they're like, "What? You're not?" And then it became a thing.
And it's been a thing ever since. One time, Chasen even received a kiss that was meant for Malone. They've been close friends for 25 years, but some of photographer Francois Brunel's subjects don't know each other at all.
There was this couple. I made one from the state of New York, and the other one was from Barcelona in Spain.
Even in those cases, Brunel notices a sense of comfort and trust between the lookalikes.
It's nice to see the connection that happens between the two people. It's like a brother or a sister.
During the photo shoot, Brunel says doppelgangers will often hug and get closer than you'd expect for total strangers. That makes sense to Michael Malone.
You instantly have something in common with somebody that is permanent, and you feel comfortable because it's somebody that looks like you, and maybe somewhere in the back of your head, your brain is saying, oh, it's okay, this person is like you.
A simple idea with a powerful impact. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Join us again tomorrow.
From PRX.